Paris Perspective.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Paris Perspective with me, David Coffey. At the beginning of this month, Germany insisted that European mediation was the best option for Armenia and Azerbaijan to reach a lasting peace agreement. The Caucasus neighbours have been locked in a decades-long conflict for control of Azerbaijan's Armenian-populated region, Nagorno-Karabakh, which Baku reclaimed in a lightning offensive this September. Armenia's Prime Minister, Nikol Pashinyan, and Azerbaijan's President, Ilham Aliyev, have held several rounds of peace talks under EU mediation, and both leaders have said that a peace treaty could be signed in the coming months. However, in October, Aliyev refused to attend a round of peace talks with Pashinyan in the Spanish city of Granada over what he said was France's biased position in the mediation. France's President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz had been scheduled to join the European Council President Charles Michel at the mediation talks. However, so far, there has been no visible progress in EU efforts to organise a fresh round of negotiations. Now, joining me today in the studio is Richard Jiragosyan, the director of the Regional Studies Centre think tank based in the Armenian capital, Yerevan. Richard, you're very welcome to Paris Perspective today.
Thank you, David.
Well, let's have a look at the backstory. We have to understand the past to know where we are at the present. Now, from the brutal war in 1988, which of course happened before the collapse of the USSR, to the conflict in 2020, in which over 6,000 people were killed in 6 weeks of fighting. Can you give us and our viewers and our listeners here on Paris Perspective a brief history of the hostilities between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh region?
Well, what we see is Nagorno-Karabakh has historically been an Armenian-populated and majority Armenian-populated region that has been very much a pawn by Moscow. It was used both in the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union to actually divide and rule in terms of keeping a contentious potential conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. What we see, though, is after seven decades of Soviet rule, there was an eruption, if you will, at the implosion of the Soviet Union. But even before that, the eruption of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, the outbreak of violence, was largely due to the onset of Gorbachev reforms. At the time, glasnost, perestroika, there was a new degree of openness, examining taboos, if you will. And what we saw was inherently the eruption of nationalism occurred between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. The conflict was both unique, but also it was the first within the borders of the former Soviet Union. But during the Gorbachev period, it was especially significant because this conflict tended to distort the development of independent Armenia and Azerbaijan in terms of conflict economics and the fact that Armenia and Azerbaijan were already locked in war upon gaining independence overnight.
It is a very interesting thing indeed. Like, this all happened before the collapse of the Soviet Union. The writing was on the wall, obviously, for the people who were living in both countries, even though themselves they might have looked at this as this is just a Russian colonial construct. But they were gearing up for a fight even before Perestroika had, you know, tried to give the fruits of an open new Russia, because nobody in the West really heard about what was happening back then.
Well, naturally. In other words, this was very much a closed space after the Soviet Union had conquered much of the Caucasus. However, I'm not sure it was that clear where it was going, because initially the Armenian quest for self-governance, self-determination in the Nagorno-Karabakh region was playing by the rules, was following the then Soviet constitution, and was very careful to adopt a non-confrontational approach. The Azerbaijani reaction was based on insecurity and threat misperception, but I do think this was an insoluble conflict. In other words, always a majority Armenian population being forced to live under Azerbaijani subordination was a result of Soviet policies rather than Armenian or Azerbaijani policies. But nevertheless, it provided a foundation for lingering and lasting conflict that distorted democratization and even led to conflict economics.
Mm-hmm. Incredibly interesting looking back. I mean, just those few decades there about how it all blew up. But I mean, even more recently now, by November 2020, the two countries, they've been at hostilities for at least 6 weeks, and they signed a Russian brokered ceasefire agreement where Armenia, the loser, agreed to give up control of 20% of the territory if you one can actually put the percentage well down on an actual map, that was captured by Azerbaijan. 2,000 Russian peacekeepers were sent to Nagorno-Karabakh. However, with the latest Azeri offensive, it's obvious that their mission has failed. Why?
Very good question, David. In fact, this context is much more important and relevant than the historical background. What we see, the war of 2020 was especially significant for several reasons. First was it marked the emergence of a genuine military capacity by Azerbaijan to not only defend itself, but to retake or attempt to retake lost territory. It was also significant because it marked an end to years of Armenian arrogance and complacency. And I blame both sides for too many missed opportunities at concession and compromise. Armenia, in many ways, was overly self-confident. And what was also interesting was the most important casualty from the war of 2020 was neither the loss of territory nor the loss of life. It was the demise of deterrence. This also ushered in a new period of insecurity on the ground. But for the Russian position, what was interesting was Nagorno-Karabakh was the only conflict without a Russian military presence. But that changed at the end of 2020. The Russians drafted and imposed their own ceasefire on both countries and then failed to be able to uphold the terms. This is why Azerbaijan later imposed a 9-month blockade and effectively later seized control of Nagorno-Karabakh. But its humiliation and weakness of the Russian peacekeepers in presence, that's most interesting. Azerbaijan has become very good at challenging and defying the Kremlin.
Poking the polecat, indeed. I mean, one thing that I want to come back there is you mentioned that there was a part of Armenian arrogance that was that was maybe catalyzed this war back in 2020. When looking from the outside in, Armenia is landlocked, surrounded by Turkey, it's got Iran to the south, it's got Azerbaijan, you know, to its east, it's got Georgia to the north, it's got another Azeri enclave behind it. Where does this arrogance come from? Who are their allies? Who's backing Yerevan to actually take such bold moves to believe that they can actually face down their aggressors and when they're totally surrounded?
Well, it's a very good question. First, Armenia very much has always been a prisoner of geography. And at the same time, surrounded by hostile or unfriendly neighbors. But I would argue no country chooses its neighbors. And in the Armenian context, there's a need or necessity for accommodating a reality of the region in terms of going along to get along. However, the arrogance in Armenia largely stemmed by the military victory over the Azerbaijanis in the late 80s and early 90s, and a degree of arrogance shaped by authoritarian leadership within Armenia, where we've had 16 years of two presidents ruling Armenia, both from Nagorno-Karabakh. The leadership at that time came to power from Nagorno-Karabakh and because of Nagorno-Karabakh. That changed in 2018 with a genuine democratic revolution, however. Mm-hmm. But the arrogance was largely defined and driven by lost opportunities, a refusal to agree to concede or compromise anything with Azerbaijan.
Very, very interesting. Now, indeed, you know, Russia still looked at itself very much as the power player. And as you said, it was a Russian imposed ceasefire. And they are the old, one could say, colonial powers there. And Russia has been traditionally allied to Armenia. But how has the Russian invasion of Ukraine affected this traditional alliance, if any?
Well, Russia's failed invasion of Ukraine, as egregious as it was, has changed everything, not just its relationship with Armenia or Azerbaijan. However, several years prior to the ill-fated invasion of Ukraine, Russia had shifted away from its pro-Armenian position, where Russia emerged several years ago as the number one arms provider to both Armenia and Azerbaijan, the ultimate position of profit, but also position geopolitically. What we also see is Russian arrogance, taking Armenia for granted, and understanding that Russia felt powerful enough with Armenia or over Armenia to prioritize an improvement of relations with Azerbaijan. This was also assisted or bolstered by a new alliance between Russia and Turkey, which historically is an aberration.
Post-2016, I take it, of course.
And the bromance between these middle-aged autocrats, presidents Erdogan and Putin, and at one time Trump. What we also see in terms of Russia, however, is Russia remains overwhelmed and distracted by its unexpected military defeat in the Ukrainian battle space, meaning that Russia is, or has been, unwilling and unable to exert its traditional leverage in the Caucasus because of Ukraine. But Russia has a long memory and a short temper. There will come a time of retribution and revenge by Russia, especially after Azerbaijan's effective humiliation of Russia's peacekeepers.
Indeed, a very, very interesting situation ongoing. But I mean, when looking at it from an Azeri perspective, the recent conflict, the most recent conflict, which I mean, many comparisons have been made, you know, with Nagorno-Karabakh and the evacuation of the entire enclave, very reminiscent of the 1915 genocide. And the Azeris are very much treating this as an out-and-out victory. But there is this question about national identity of people who live in Nagorno-Karabakh. I mean, Baku maintains that the people of the Artsakh, if one could say the Armenian population of Karabakh, that they have the same rights as Azeris. But what exactly is the reality on the ground?
Well, first of all, even prior to the most recent escalation, there was little faith and no confidence in Azerbaijani's promises, largely because of the historical record. During the Gorbachev period through the 90s, there were a number of anti-Armenian massacres and, unfortunately, egregious human rights violations. And the situation has only gotten worse in recent years. What we also see, however, was the successful Azerbaijani military offensive in September was remarkably quick and, for their point of view, easy in terms of driving out the Armenian population from Nagorno-Karabakh.
And that was their goal?
Well, yes, but what was interesting, I would argue, is their real objective was a protracted period for domestic political dividends within Azerbaijan. The Azerbaijani campaign initially expected a longer, protracted campaign.
To be able to garner more support from back home, to use it as a tool.
Yes, to also maintain power with the lack of legitimacy.
So they were almost, one could say that politically they were the victim of their own success.
And still are, with dangerously high expectations. But before we look at the situation in Azerbaijan, what's interesting about the exodus from Nagorno-Karabakh, the Armenian population was forced to leave with little more than they could pack in their automobiles. And coming to Armenia, the core population of the last remnants of 100,000 Armenians are not necessarily keen to stay in Armenia. Many are now looking to go to Russia or European countries because many of the Armenians from Karabakh have never lived in Armenia.
Yeah.
Their ancestral homeland has always been different, mm-hmm. Nagorno-Karabakh. Mm-hmm. I moved to Armenia over 15 years ago, and I'm as alien or foreign to the local Armenian experience as they are.
Sure.
And that's something we fail to understand. For the Azerbaijani side, there was perhaps a misperception that a small number of Armenians would be willing to stay and live with Azerbaijani passports. Yeah. But that was both unrealistic and also rather disingenuous.
Well, speaking of, well, disingenuous, but well, one thing was definitely came to the fore and was the victors go the spoils, and that was this latest military parade by Azerbaijan in Nagorno-Karabakh. You know, we've just spoke of this mass exodus with a whole 100,000 people leaving north to the old country, if you want to call it as such, with being Irish, I understand diaspora and second generation, third generation who have never actually lived in the old country. But 100 to 150,000 people left with nothing but the clothes on their backs or, you know, whatever they could fit into their car. So who exactly was in Nagorno-Karabakh to see this military parade that was launched by the Azerbaijanis?
Well, obviously the real audience was the Azerbaijani media and film crews that were on hand to record this historic achievement of reconquering in a almost Middle Ages style reconquering or conquest.
It does come across as very Middle Ages because there was no one in the streets waving flags.
Well, I would go even further. This so-called victory was actually came after 9 months of a Middle Ages style siege of Nagorno-Karabakh. Mm. Very much the Game of Thrones in the Caucasus.
They cut off the Lachin Corridor. Yes. They wouldn't let that
starve the population.
That connects Azerbaijan.
Besieged the capital and the castle, if you will.
Yeah.
What we also see, however, is where we are now. Mm. What comes next? Armenia has lost Nagorno-Karabakh effectively. But the outlook for stability and the future of Armenia remains much more positive than it does for Azerbaijan. Because the real danger now for Azerbaijan is the necessity to deliver to the population and to keep the Azerbaijani domestic population distracted from the lack of democracy and the family corruption of the Aliyev government.
Now, we've got a lot to cover here. So briefly, kind of just to kind of wrap up our little the military victory. And I know the Azeri army were also parading, you know, what they had stolen from the Nagorno-Karabakh separatists, you know, parading all of the weapons that they have actually confiscated, had taken. But I mean, in tandem with all of this, Turkey and Azerbaijan recently held a joint military operation around Karabakh, ironically entitled the Mustafa Kemal Ataturk exercise. What kind of message was that sending to Yerevan ahead of peace talks? But also, what does it send to the greater region, and more specifically, Tehran to the south?
Well, I would argue that specific military exercise was especially worrisome in Armenia, precisely because the start of the war of 2020 was under the cover of a joint military exercise with Turkey. This is why many analysts and many military observers, including those in the U.S. and Europe, fail to see that war coming. Mm. What we also see, however, is what you highlighted, David. The real audience, the real message of that joint exercise was not Armenia. It was to the north, showing strength to Russia and feeding the perception of blind Turkish support, and a message to the south, to Iran, especially after recent flare-ups of tension between Azerbaijan and Iran, which are driven by the return of the Israeli leader, Benjamin Netanyahu.
Sure. Exactly, indeed. Just when we thought things might have been normalized between the West and Tehran, well, everything has gone. That's unfortunately another topic. We won't delve into that too much today. But we, you know, you're here in Paris, and it's great to have you on the program. So we have to mention, indeed, you know, the French influence in the Caucasus, and indeed, France is home to one of the world's largest Armenian populations, or at least part of the diaspora. One of the first countries to actually recognize the Armenian genocide only a little over 20 years ago. So, you know, about the diaspora here in France and, you know, the recognition of genocide committed by the Young Turk administration back in 1915. Do you, however, think that France has actually done enough to support Armenia and its isolation in the region?
Well, to be fair, I do, because French engagement has actually exceeded expectations. Mm. But at the same time, it's the EU engagement that's both more significant and more effective than simple French actions. Yeah. What I mean is, as important as President Macron's commitment to Armenia is, there is a wider European context that's necessary for sustaining the resiliency of Armenia. Mm. The French will be announcing a package of military assistance to Armenia in the coming days or weeks, designed to provide a defensive capacity to Armenia. But it's the EU engagement, because they're not trying to mediate the conflict. They are simply trying to facilitate a negotiated peace treaty between Armenia and Azerbaijan. My worry is the day after.
Yeah.
What is in store to ensure a lasting, durable peace? That remains an open question, and one in which France, within the EU, can actually work toward.
Well, I mean, isn't there a difficulty there that has been highlighted? You know, we had a French delegation of mayors, including the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, who went to the border with Nagorno-Karabakh for the opening of the Lachin corridor, bringing aid there. And then there's the sale of weapons to Yerevan, defense systems and all that. But this has been reacted to by Iliev, Azerbaijan, who's accused Paris of meddling in regional affairs. Does he have a point?
He does, to be quite fair. Mm. The Azerbaijani president, most recently Ilham Aliyev, had boycotted a meeting that was set to bring together the Armenian and Azerbaijani leadership for talks in Granada, Spain. But to be fair, Aliyev felt cornered. Azerbaijan felt outnumbered because of the French and German role. This yeah. was no longer Charles Michel leading EU facilitation. Mm-hmm. And hence, Aliyev demanded that President Erdogan from Turkey also be allowed to participate. So I do think the response of the boycott, as destructive as it was effective yeah. and was understandable for their point of view. However, what is often missing from the Azerbaijani and Turkish rhetoric against French engagement is the reality that France was a longstanding member of the OSCE's Minsk group, which was the only diplomatic entity mediating or empowered to mediate the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. Mm. It was the United States, Russia, and France, not the EU.
Yeah.
So to be fair, there is a degree of legitimacy in the French role here.
It goes back over 30 years, exactly. It was 1992.
Yes,
that Minsk
but more recently, the onset of democracy in Armenia endows the Armenian government with greater legitimacy. Hence, the personal chemistry between the Armenian Prime Minister, Nicole Pashinyan, the Canadian Premier, Justin Trudeau, and French President Macron. Mm-hmm. It's become a personal relationship.
And they're all in their 40s. It kind of works. There's a certain
and
generation.
Similar
thing.
Leaders yeah. as yeah. well.
Now, before we, because we will go on to the domestic politics and talk about Pashinyan himself. But before we do that, I mean, you did say an interesting point there about bringing the Turks to the table. Now, recently we've seen a lot of fast forwarding of Ukraine's accession and Moldova's accession to the European Union because of the power play that's obviously going on, to the east of the European bloc. But Armenia's accession to the EU is very much on the cards. Turkey, Armenia, you know, lining up to join the EU. Now, Turkey has obviously been shunned and has been kind of kept in the doldrums there for the past decade or so. But is a full normalization of relations with Turkey in any way an option or an avenue for a lasting peace between Yerevan and Baku if they were all under the same umbrella of an EU, at least coming in as observer status or whatever higher levels you get before full actual accession?
Well, the short answer is no. The longer answer is more complicated, as usual. In terms of my own support for the normalization of relations between Armenia and Turkey, and having been to Ankara several times, I do think the real challenge is that Turkey has become prisoner of Azerbaijan.
Yeah.
The little brother of the relationship has an upper hand and actually decides Turkish policy options in the Caucasus as a whole. But nevertheless, we do expect, given the new post-war reality, an opportunity to fulfill expectations to normalize relations. Because normalization is a low-hanging fruit. It is not reconciliation, but it is a step toward constructive stability and peace. In other words, it's important, but it's not enough to ensure that Azerbaijan will remain satisfied. Because the real danger here is a peace treaty taking back Nagorno-Karabakh. This may not be enough for Azerbaijan for domestic reasons, which needs conflict.
But indeed, it'd be the first signpost on a potential roadmap, essentially. Now, moving on to the actual political situation in the old country, what is Pashinyan's position at the moment? I mean, he looking from the outside in, he's, you know, he always seems to be caught between a rock and a hard place. He faced down a potential coup d'etat back in 2021. And, you know, it would appear now he's coming to a negotiating table with Azerbaijan when those talks eventually do kick off. One could say with a proverbial or actual literal gun to his head to actually make a deal because he has no choice. But again, is this another humiliation and how does that wash politically in Yerevan and across Armenia itself?
Well, I do think there's an interesting paradox, and that is we have a more democratic government. We have the leadership of Nikol Pashinyan as prime minister, who's the first Armenian leader in many years, not from Nagorno-Karabakh, without a nationalist pedigree, much more populist. But at the same time, he and his government were overwhelmingly reelected in early elections despite losing a war in 2020. There is a degree of resilience by the government, largely because of the near total discredited nature of the opposition.
Yeah.
There's simply no alternative to Pashinyan today. Nevertheless, I do think he's endowed with a rare commodity of legitimacy after genuinely free and fair elections. And this is the advantage Armenia has over Azerbaijan. And it's a mandate to govern rather than an authoritarian ruler of Azerbaijan.
And in all fairness, when push comes to shove and the peace talks really do get into motion, what exactly is being proposed that actually will work in Armenia's favor? And what do you believe will be the end game that will actually put a lid on it and create a lasting peace?
Well, let me be provocative. I think the real challenge now is less the peace treaty and more Russia for Armenia. But if we look at the peace treaty, the specific elements, Nagorno-Karabakh is no longer an issue within a bilateral peace treaty. However, border demarcation, as well as the restoration of trade and transport, the opening of road and railway links, are significant aspects, but both positive in terms of moving beyond and moving forward. The real challenge is Russia in terms of Armenia now seeking greater room to maneuver. We're not seeking to replace Russia, but we're seeking to offset Russia. For Armenia, Russia has emerged as a new, more serious challenge, that of an unreliable so-called partner.
Well, my thanks there to Richard Jiragosian from the Regional Studies Center in Yerevan, who's joined me today here on Paris Perspective.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining me on Paris Perspective. And you can get, of course, all of our previous editions of our Paris Perspective podcast on RFI English/podcast, and indeed wherever you get your podcasts. From me, David Coffey, talk to you very soon.